She's the media maven with her finger on the pulse of the heartbeat of Chicago. If it's happening in the Windy City, she's got you covered. Now here's the lady that puts the fun in fundraising, Candid Candace Jordan.
Well, I have to tell you the truth. I never get tired of hearing that opening. You know, that is the fabulous Jennifer Weigel doing this incredible opening for me. And I just, every time I hear it, I hope I can be as good as the opening. So anyway, John St. Augustine is on. I mean, he's my producer and my co-host.
I'm basically your parasitic twin at this point. Just attached at the hip and let's go.
I can't believe you put up with me this long, but I'm very thrilled about it. Well, I have to tell you today, I'm so excited with this podcast, which is our third, by the way, and I'm really pleased about that, because I'm talking to a man who I have been so enamored with ever since I first met him in Chicago or heard his name. I mean, he's a legend. He is Rick Kogan. He wears many, many hats. He's been 38 years at the Tribune. He's got, you know, TV critic, film critic, a movie critic, writer, has 8 books under his belt, you know, his own radio shows. It goes on and on and on. There's nothing that he can't do. And he has agreed to be on the show. So the tables are turned. Usually he interviews me on his fabulous WGN radio show, but now we're going to turn the tables on him, and I'm excited to have him on.
If there was a theme for Rick Kogan, that's frickin' the theme right there.
That is the theme. That was fabulous. What do you think, Rick?
I'm thrilled.
Do you have
with
a new theme song?
I'm thrilled with any theme. I am thrilled with any theme. What are my claim to fame? Hit listening to the opening of your wonderful show, and I am now certifiably the biggest fan of your podcast. I used to be among my many, many, many jobs, some of which you listed. Mm-hmm. I babysat Jennifer Weigel.
Oh my goodness.
Jennifer and her brother. I don't know what was wrong. Her father was one of my dearest friends and one of the grand talents in the history of this town, Tim Weigel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not just a sportscaster with colorful clothing. He was a brilliant writer and a wonderful guy. Mm-hmm. And maybe one of his only failings is when he was at one point between wives and had 2 young children named Jennifer and Rafer. He asked me when I was in my 20s to babysit the kids. Everybody I knew would say, he asked you to do what? He asked the 27-year-old Rick Kogan to babysit somebody? They're never gonna survive. And it was tough because Rafer and Jen came over and they were very little, you know, 6, 7 maybe. And I had no idea what to get them. They told me, they said, well, I said, what do you guys eat? Well, we get to eat, every night we get to eat pizza. So I ordered pizza and they said, and we'd like to drink Cokes. And I got them some Cokes. And what else do you do? We like to watch TV. So we watch TV. And I ran out of things to do, so I taught them tricks, like how to tie a cigarette into a knot. I did not have a huge repertoire of things to teach little kids, but I've known those guys forever, and it's not my place to be proud of Jen and Rafer, but I really am proud of those 2 kids. And
they're
sad.
Awesome.
You know, Tim died in his 50s, and it was... one of the great tragedies of my life, and I think one of the great tragedies on the media scene here, too.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
One of the most amazing stories I've ever come across in my life is that I wrote not only the obituary of Tim Weigel, but also the obituary of Gene Siskel. Mm. And the fact that those men died of brain tumors... Mm. And both had been roommates at Yale as freshmen. I convinced the newspaper at the time, when newspapers sent some money, to send someone out to Yale University to see if there was some kind of connection in the dormitory. It's one of the most astonishing things. The two guys, if you had met Tim and Gene when they were freshmen in college, you would have found the two most unlikely people to ever be major television stars. You know, this wasn't, these were not the typical anchorman looks.
Yeah.
And the fact that they both died at roughly the same age, in the late 50s, of brain tumor is something that haunts me to this day. Isn't that amazing, Candace?
That's amazing. Did anybody follow up on that kind of a report to see anything about that?
We tried. You know, we tried and got nothing. There was nothing.
That is really super strange. I've never heard that before.
I know. It was. It's still, it's the spookiest confluence of, it's more somehow than a coincidence to me.
I think so, too. That sounds really strange.
And we tried to track it down. At one point, I thought, oh, my God, whatever that dormitory is must have dozens of similar cases, but we couldn't find it. It's just one of the weird incidents in my life, at least.
Oh, well, if anybody hears this and has been stricken with that, maybe they can reach out to somebody. That just sounds horrifying.
Yeah, it is.
Well,
let's get on
to a brighter note here now, Rick. Let's try to lighten this story show up a little bit.
You don't like my tying a cigarette in a knot for two
Oh, no,
fights.
That's a highlight.
Two seven-year-olds, yeah, like, hi, kids, here.
And then, we're going to have Jennifer Weigel on soon, and so I'm definitely going to ask her about that.
Oh, yeah.
That's haunted her all these years.
I don't think it's haunted her. I think it is one of her most pleasant memories ever, frankly. I know it is Rafer. I know it's one of Rafer's. Years later, Rafer would, I think when he was with his first wife, we were at some party or something, he goes, hey, Rick, can you do for my first wife that tie a cigarette and a knot thing you did? And then 30 years later, I had lost my magic touch.
Oh, shoot. Well, that I would like to know how to do that. That must be a great trick.
I'll show you, Candace.
Show me. Well, I want to get back to the fact of my intro about you. You know, what amazes me is that you just do it all. I mean, you're a journalist, you're an author, TV host, radio host, editor, critic. Of all those hats, which one gives you the most pleasure or has given you the most pleasure?
Writing. I mean, that is also, I think, the basis of what has come afterward. I mean, I started as a writer. I wrote from the time I was a little tiny boy. My first columns in newspapers were for the famous Near North News.
Oh, yeah.
And I wrote a little tiny column, I think it was about 11, called Notes from Old Town. It was just about, like, of course, my father, who was an esteemed journalist here and knew a lot of people, but Lou Mariano was a writer, and I think he may have been the publisher of the North Loop News. And so for a time, I wrote a little column called Notes from Old Town about what I was doing and Ty Bowler and all these other kids I used to pal around with. And it's all grown, Candace, out of the word, I think. You know, the word led to, you know, I would be a guest on radio shows, and here's a sort of interesting story nobody knows. I was often a guest on Steve Dahl and Kevin Matthews shows on The Loop, and I'd come in and talk about, when I was an editor at the Tribune, about how people would complain about the comic strips. That they didn't really care what was on the front page. They just cared about what the comic strip said and how I would deal with this. And I came off the air one day, and Larry Wirt and Jim DeCastro, who ran the station, said, you know, hey, how you know, you're really good on the radio. Do you want to have a show? And I said, oh, sure, yeah, fine, just tell me when. And they literally said, well, how about this Sunday? I go, yeah, that's well, great, see you later. And I assumed they were joking. That Friday, I get a call at work from a friend of mine saying, hey, when did you get a show on the radio? And I go, what do you mean? Well, they're advertising a show, a Sunday morning show hosted by you. And I thought, are you kidding? I called these guys, and they said, yeah, you said you'd do it. I said, I didn't expect to do it in 2 days. So I came in that Sunday morning. There was some hungover engineer there, and he said, are you Rick? I go, yeah. What am I supposed to do? He goes, well, it's your show. You can do whatever you want. So I called it the Sunday Papers even then, and I thought what I would do is go through the papers and tell people what was in the papers and what this story was, sort of the news behind the news.
Realizing,
of course, that I should have read the papers before I started doing this. Because I began by saying, well, here's an interesting story on page 8. And then I'd start to read the story with it, leaving nothing but dead air. I finally got to the point where I realized this wasn't happening, so I called my friend Dennis DeYoung, who was the leader of the band Styx, and begged him to come on, and he spent 2 hours on the air just telling stories of what it was like to be on the rock and roll road. But it all came out of the printed word, and I think, in essence, that's sort of the way it is for you too, Candace. You have a radio show because you're such a talented writer, and you go to so many events, and you see, you cover the waterfront in this town.
Yeah.
And, you know, years ago, many, 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 many years ago, 100 years or so, there was no radio. It was all print. But now you can expand from that, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that is what many media people try to do. I never really tried to do it. I never had any ambitions to be on TV or on radio. It just happened that way, and I enjoy it. I mean, I enjoy it. They're both TV and radio are both very interesting mediums. They're vastly different than writing, but they're interesting forms of communication. I think that's the whole key. It's all about communicating.
It is. And I'll tell you, you have one of the best voices in radio that I've ever heard. I mean, listen, the last time that we were on together, my 95-year-old aunt said, "Oh my God, who's that handsome voice attached to?" I mean,
does he have a girlfriend? Yeah, well, that's good. Well,
anyway.
Yeah, you too. Well, the funny story about that, when I started at WGN, I did the show, and there was some young intern there. And she comes up and says, "Yeah, Mr. Kogan, can I ask you a question?" Sure. She goes, "Like, where did you go to broadcasting school?" I go, "Well, I didn't go to broadcasting school. I didn't even go to college." And I go, "Well, why?" "Well, I'd really like to, you know, to follow in your footsteps, and your voice is just so amazing." And I said, "Well, I don't know what to tell you. I didn't go to broadcasting school." And she looks at me with a disdainful look and says, "Oh, I see. You're not willing to help people who want to get in the business." And I said, "Okay, honey, I'll help you. If you would like right now to start smoking and drinking for the next 40 years, then you two can have a voice like this and an hour-long show once a week. If that's really what you want to do, go ahead." I appreciate the voice, but it's, you know, it was not easy, Candace. It was not easy.
I should have guessed it was
smoking for all those years.
From years of abuse, I should have guessed it.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, you like you said, you did grow up in Old Town, and that's such a unique area. It was filled with all kinds of, you know, media talent and writers like your mom and your dad. And tell me what happened back then, because I know that your apartment was like the hotbed of all this activity. I mean, and that's what you grew up used to. Give us a little flavor about what that was like.
Well, it was a sort of railroad apartment, as they used to call them in the day before they became hugely expensive condominiums. It was on the second floor of an old building at 1715 North Park, sort of in the Crilly Court neighborhood between Eugenia and St. Paul. And the distinctive memories I have, as my younger brother does too, is being awakened at, I don't know what time, probably midnight, by my mother, who would come in and say, "Come on, wake up, you two, wake up, Ricky and Mark. You're going to go say goodbye, good night to all the nice people." And so we'd get up in our pajamas covered with cowboys or race cars or something, and we'd walk down the hall into the living room, which was like some kind of early Star Wars bar filled with interesting characters like, you know, Marcel Marceau, the famous mime. Studs was always there. Nelson Algren was always there. Jim Hoag was there. Win Strachey, who founded the Old Town School, was there. and a bunch of other people. And the memory was of a room just filled with cigarette smoke and friendly laughing faces and the sound of ice against glass and cocktails. And we would come in, and I don't remember. It was sort of alluringly terrifying, Candace. But incredibly memorable. And that's, you know, it was a really lucky, my father was an author and a drama critic and knew a lot of people. You know, Mort Saul came there for drinks. And my mother was an ebullient, grand personality. So the apartment was always filled with interesting people, some of them famous, some of them artists, some of them bums, but it was always kind of a lively scene. And Old Town, of course, was in those days before it got rarefied. You know, two buildings away was a man lived there with his wife, a man named Slim Williams, who had come to Chicago from Alaska driving a dog team to be in the Century of Progress exhibition at along the lakefront, the World's Fair along the lakefront. And Henry Rago, the editor of Poetry Magazine. It was just, and you know, the Bowler family, the son and grandkids of the alderman of the 43rd Ward, Patty Bowler, who ran his corrupt ward office from a saloon at 403 West North Avenue, just west of Sedgwick. And Ty, my best friend growing up was Ty, Matthias Bowler, named after Matthias Patty Bowler. See, Patty was German, and of course, it took the name Patty so he would you know, appeal to Irish voters. But Ty and I would go over to his saloon, that's where he ran his business, out of a saloon, you know, with some frequency when we got to be about 11 or 12, and we'd sit there with his, and he was a slob. Patty was really a slob, big fat guy with all sorts of mementos of his many trips to Hong Kong hanging in the saloon. And we knew we'd sit there, and he'd ask us a few, he loved my father because my father had written a book called Lords of the Levee with his friend Lloyd Wendt, which was the chronicle of the misdeeds of two incredibly corrupt aldermen who sort of set the bar for aldermanic corruption, Bathhouse John Coughlin and Michael Hinky Dink Kenna. Oh, sure. And he loved my dad. He revered my dad, so I could easily go in there, and we'd sit there for 10 minutes, and Patty would go, okay, how are the grades in the school, you guys? And we go, they're great, Grandpa. They're good. We get all A's and blah, blah, blah. And they're all these sort of weirdos, you know, factotums hanging around. And so after about 10 minutes, he'd give us each $10, and he'd go spend this at John Merlo's ice cream store down to North Avenue. And we'd just take it and do, I don't know what you did with it, but $10 was a lot of dough in those days. But it's, yeah, so it was a really lively, colorful kind of... wonderful kind of childhood.
Oh, I'll say. Well, you know, growing up with all those characters and celebrities, you probably weren't intimidated by anybody. Are you intimidated by, have you been intimidated by anybody that you've met?
No, I think that's a good point. That's a really good question, Candace. Mm. I don't think it's a matter of being intimidated or starstruck. I certainly couldn't be starstruck when, you know, when you could ask Marcel Marceau to, like, the most famous mime.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And, like, you know, could you do something or ask Mort Saul to tell you a joke or something? Right. I realized that, and it was such an interesting mix of people that the stars and everybody else in there were all, to me, on the same kind of level.
Right.
And yeah. I think, and my father and mother both, who spent a lot of time. I mean, Carol Channing changed my diapers, for God's sake.
My God.
Yeah, I remember telling her that when I finally was old enough and interviewed her. I go, I was flown up. I was at the Daily News. I flew up to Detroit to interview in a hotel room, and I hadn't seen her probably in many, 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 many years. Mm-hmm. And my first question to her, and the first time I've ever asked anybody I've interviewed this question, You know, I said, Miss Channing, do you have and possibly at all remember changing my diapers?
And her answer?
She answered in that incredible voice, well, of course I do, Ricky. Of course I do.
Ricky.
But no, it was never intimidating. I just, there was a joy. I mean, you realize, yeah. I think I realized early on that some so-called celebrities were didn't deserve to be celebrated.
Right.
And some regular people, normal people, so-called everyday people, did need to be celebrated. Mm-hmm. So it was never an intimidation kind of thing. It was always kind of a joy. It was like any kind of story. You know, I've covered a lot of fires and a lot of bad things in my day, but and you just treat, it was always treat human beings as human beings. And if they had something interesting to say, or they were particularly nice. When I interviewed Tom Hanks, we talked mostly about typewriters. I don't know how that came up, but he had a real, years ago, and now he collects like crazy, but a real passion for typewriters.
Yeah, and I heard that.
I tried to, Candace, in my entire career, treat everybody equally. I'm not the kind of guy who looks through a waitress, for instance. Some of that is hanging around, not just my father, but Studs Terkel too. There is value, to my mind, in everybody. There may not be a front page story in everybody, but there's a story in almost everybody.
Oh, and you find the best stories, Rick. I love it. You know, you wrote recently about Bughouse Square. And I remember one time you told me a fascinating story about Studs Terkel when he passed. Can you share that story with us?
Oh, sure. I spent a, after my father died in 1989, and I spent an inordinate amount of time with Studs afterward. If my father had lived, it would have been the three of us, but a lot of time with Studs afterward. Mm-hmm. And so Studs, his wife Ida died she died on Christmas Eve, about 6 years before Studs died on Halloween, of all days. And whenever I would visit Studs, and he got increasingly frail as he got into his 90s, his hearing was shot, as he would have told you. And so he had Ida's ashes put in a little urn. And sitting next to the yellow daisies that were her favorite flower. And so one day, he was not feeling well. He's probably about 93 at this point. And he was about to go in for a heart operation. And he said, "Now, Rick, you gotta, when I check out." He never used the word die or death. He used variations, seriously, he used variations of checking out because he was a hotel kid. You know, when I check out, you got to do me a favor. I go, "Stud, I don't want to talk about this. What do you, Rick? You got to do this. You got to get me, take my ashes, and mix them up with Ida's. They're right here. Ida's are right here on the windowsill. See them?" I go, "Okay." And mix them together and bury us in Bughouse Square. And I said, "Stud, you know you can't do that. It's against the law. You can't just arbitrarily bury people anywhere you feel like in this city." And he looks at me and he goes, "Let them sue us. Let them sue us." And so we did. I mean, there was a group of about 8 or 10 of us buried him underneath the tree. The tree is no longer there, but Studs and Ida are buried in Bughouse Square. It was a very important place for him because as a young man, living not far away, he spent a lot of time there when Bughouse Square was in the heyday of being a free speech kind of emporium. And he always said he may not have learned much about politics or anything else, but he learned a lot about life, Rick, a lot about life. And he was hugely influential in my life because he never took anybody for granted.
Yeah.
And talk to anybody, and his radio show was a miracle, a miracle.
What, that he could do it, or that he had one, or both?
No, I think the reason he had one because when WFMT first started, You know, Studs had been blacklisted because of Studs would say, "Rick, I never met a pamphlet I wouldn't sign. I never met a protest I wouldn't sign." So he had some strange affiliations. He was not a communist, for Christ's sake, but. But there was one, he was so blacklisted that when CBS came to Chicago and they were going to do a concert in the theater that used to be in the Wrigley Building, not Wrigley Field, in the Wrigley Building, and the star of the show was Mahalia Jackson, arguably the most famous gospel singer in history. And so Mahalia was there with Studs, and they're getting ready, they're trying to rehearse. And Studs was the first person to play Mahalia Jackson records in Chicago when he had a radio show before his famous radio show. So they knew each other well. And some suit from CBS came up and told Studs that he had to leave because the CBS could not have him introduce Mahalia Jackson in this whole thing. So the way Studs told the story is Mahalia came up to him and said, "Now, what's the matter, baby? Why is that man talking to you?" "They don't want me to do this because of some thing I signed 20 years ago." And so Mahalia Jackson grabbed Studs by the hand, walked over to this guy, this CBS guy, and said, "Now, you don't want Mr. Turco to introduce me?" He goes, that's right. "I'm terribly sorry about that. We just can't have him do that." He goes, she says, "Well, if there's no Mr. Turco, you don't got Mahalia Jackson." And obviously the guy made a few phone calls and the show went on with Studs.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, isn't that a great story?
Oh, that is a great story. I love Mahalia Jackson. You know, I want to ask you,
yes.
Your parents, since they were both writers, did they want you to be a writer as well? How did they influence you?
God, no. You know, my father at one point when I was probably a teenager, he would say, "Why don't you get into something respectable like drug dealing?" He knew the downside of newspaper work, though he had a terribly successful career at it. I'll give you one quick, I don't tell this story often, but once, and Royko told me years later too, but once we were out at, he was very good friends with Marshall Field IV, who owned the Sun-Times and Daily News. And at one point, we were out at Marshall's house. He had a big estate in Libertyville. And I'm a kid. I'm 10 or something. Mm-hmm. And so Marshall's a little loaded, as he could be on occasion. And that is when he told me, he said, "You know, I love your father. I love your father. You know, your father would be editor of the newspaper if he wasn't a Jew." And we were not practicing Jews or anything, but I was stunned by that, much more stunned later in life when Royko told me that Marshall Field had told him the same thing. I'm thinking,
Jesus Christ,
you know, Herman would be editor of the paper if he wasn't a Jew. But he knew the, certainly the joys of newspapering, but also the pains of it too. I don't think, he never, ever forced me into journalism. My brother, younger brother Mark, 16 months younger, Irish twins, went to McGill, graduated McGill School of Journalism. Yeah. He had a summer job at the Tribune as an intern. And I was, at the time, I dropped out of college and lived in Spain for a while. And I'm driving a cab. So we meet to celebrate at the Wrigley Building restaurant. And Mark sits there and tells us about my father says, the Tribune had offered him a job, full-time job, right out of school. And that's great, Mark. And my father's remembering, I remember I made $14.50 a week when I got hired at City News. And I'm thinking to myself, I've got two pockets filled with change that is my salary and tips here. I'm making noise. And my brother's talking about a full-time job. And he says, "Well, I turned them down." And we're both like, "What?" And my father says, "What are you going to do?" And he explains to us, "Well, Dad," he says, "I've been contracting some of the football players at Northwestern, to be security and bodyguards at concerts that people have been putting on. And now I'm actually incredulous. So what? What do you mean? Well, I think I'm going to join this firm and get in the concert business. Jeez. And he did. He did. He went to work for that operation that was contracting the football players eventually became Jam Productions. And Mark eventually managed the Chicago Stadium for the legendary Jerry Weintraub, and then became, for a time, the sort of leading road manager in America. He did Elvis. He did.
Oh, Mike.
He is the guy.
Wow.
Name a band. He is the guy. Footnote in musical history. He's up at Alpine Valley. Okay, I mean at the concert venue in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And he's there, and he gets a phone call. No cell phones. He gets a phone call, and it is Jerry Weintraub, who managed Elvis and who managed Frank Sinatra.
Oh, my God.
He says, "Mark, everything okay?" "Yeah, I'm waiting for Frank. Frank just landed in Milwaukee. He's got a police escort across Wisconsin. He'll be here in about 25 minutes. Mark, you got to do a big favor for me." "Yes, Mr. Weintraub. I got bad news, and you got to tell Frank." "What is it, Mr. Weintraub?" "Elvis is dead." And Mark, "Geez, Mr. Weintraub, I just saw him last week. What happened?" "He died in his bathroom at Graceland. You got to tell Frank." And Mark is like, I "Can't you?" Eventually, he says, "Okay." And Mark tells the story that Frank pulls in with a police escort and a white limousine that's just come from Mitchell Field in Milwaukee, and he gets out of the car and he starts walking over to Mark, and he says, and Mark does a great Sinatra impersonation. "You go, Mark, what's the matter? You don't look good. Mr. Sinatra, I'm so sorry. Elvis Presley is dead." The Frank
Sinatra,
turned white,
yeah.
Walked backstage, sat at a card table where there was a phone, and spent the next 6 hours calling people. One of my ambitions is to one day write a play called Elvis is Dead and try to resurrect. Who in God's name was Sinatra calling?
I mean,
these guys at the time were arguable. I mean, they certainly were among the top 10 most famous people in the world.
Right.
You know, along with the Pope and maybe Muhammad Ali. That's another thing, the story that's always haunted me. Mark went on to have a very successful career in music, not journalism.
Oh, for goodness sake.
He was a very talented writer. And I told him when he first went on the road, I said, "Mark, all you have to do, talk into a tape recorder for a half hour every night, and you'll have a book whenever this thing's over." And he never did that. And
that would have been a brilliant idea.
Yeah, because I've heard a lot of these stories, and they are really pretty amazing. Pretty amazing.
God.
But Colonel Parker demanding that he come downstairs in Vegas to play craps with him at 3 o'clock in the morning because Colonel Parker had nobody to play craps with.
What a nasty man he seemed to have been.
Mark thought he was, Mark has a different kind of opinion of him, but he has, he knew these people way better than I would, or better than any movie could ever do that.
Isn't that wonderful? He knew, I mean, even though he was offered that position, he still followed his heart. I think that's such a great lesson. I think everybody should do something like that. Follow your passion.
No question.
I want to get back to your, and you were famous about writing these, your obituaries. They're like works of art.
Thanks.
And I know that one of the ones that you had covered was Hugh Hefner.
Yep.
And, we have that in common. I mean, obviously I loved him. Tell me what you thought about Hugh Hefner.
Well, I went out to interview Mr. Hefner after he had not done many interviews for a time. I think he had just broken up with his then wife, and I used some certain connections that I had in Chicago. My father knew, A.C. Spektorsky and some of the editors in the magazine, and I flew out to interview him at his home in Holmley Hills. And I found him to be flat out fascinating, thoughtful. I'd known his daughter Christy for many, many years. And I found was he unusual? Well, hell yes. I mean, I'm not sure there's any, you know, the difference is you look at Hugh Hefner being unusual and you look at some goof like Elon Musk. I mean, Elon Musk should be in a zoo or something. I think he was a genius. I think he was a wonderful civil libertarian and a incredible defender of the First Amendment. And I don't think Hugh Hefner was weird on any level. This is a man who you had to give certain break. Yeah, okay, you lived in a mansion. Okay, a lot of women lived in the mansion. When some of those dispiriting kind of documentaries, so to speak, came out, I thought this was horrible. Just someone trying to pick at a corpse. Mm-hmm. I think Hefner will be remembered as he is by you, mm-hmm. and by me, and by anyone who ever met him. He told me a story. Sometimes he would walk out of the mansion when the Playboy Mansion was on State Street here. That sometimes he would just leave whatever party, and there were a lot of parties there, mm-hmm. Whatever party was going on with whoever he was dating at the time, and they would walk around the Gold Coast and sometimes kind of stare into windows and look at the families. He especially liked to do it when it was snowing and around Christmas time. Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of, you know, in many ways he yearned mm-hmm. for that, because mm-hmm. he had to sacrifice that in order to do what he did.
That's right.
That's the way. I am an incredible admirer of what he did and will not stomach any kind of uninformed opinion mm-hmm. of Hugh Hefner. I think he's one of the most important people to ever call Chicago home.
Oh, I think that's so true. I appreciate you saying that. I agree with you 100%.
I know you do.
100%. You know, I want to talk a little bit about Chicago.
Sure.
You've been here, you know, obviously for a long time, and you've seen changes, and you've seen them good changes, bad changes. What do you think the state of Chicago is in now, and where do you think we might be headed? Tell me some good things and what bad things you see.
Well, I think the state is pretty precarious. I mean, you know, I talk to people of a certain age here, and they are scared. Mm-hmm. They are scared of crime. They are scared of the fact that you walk down Michigan Avenue now and you'll find a whole block, the Verizon store, you'll find a block of empty storefronts, mm-hmm. Which is, I don't know what exactly that translates to for a lot of people. I have ever been hopeful about Chicago and indeed about life. Mm-hmm. You know, I know Brandon Johnson, mm-hmm. my lovely girlfriend who you know well, my mm-hmm. longtime girlfriend. He and mm-hmm. she and Brandon were hired on the very same day.
Oh, for goodness sake.
At the teachers union. So I know him. I know some of the people he's surrounding himself with. I don't think he's ever going to go to jail for corruption. I could mm-hmm. be wrong, because that's a weird position to be in, but I do not think that's going to be the case. And I think he wants Chicago to be healthy. You know, there's so many variables in this whole thing, Candace, like who's going to be the new superintendent of police, and what's the economy going to be like. It's hard for me to lose faith. I know a lot of people have lost faith and they've left mm-hmm. Chicago. But, you know, there was a big fire in 1871,
we're still here.
City bounced back, and there were mobsters shooting each other on the sidewalks in the 20s, I think the crime has to get under control, I think, mm-hmm, and that's mm-hmm. that will calm a lot of people.
Right, I agree. You know, everybody's got a different writing style. I mean, you know, John does, I do, and I know you do. Tell me about a day in the life of Rick.
Well, I sleep in, and then I try to rouse myself.
Are you an early riser or a late riser?
I try to rouse myself to do an hour on the radio with my friend Candace, and it's an all day. I'm up early. I'm generally up about 5.
Okay.
Between 5 and 6, and I'll generally go exercise for a time.
You exercise. That's good.
All
right.
Oh, yeah. Every day. I've always played sports. I used to, first it was handball with Royko, and then it was tennis. And, I've always ever since I was a child.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it is good. And it's I could not. Could not, frankly, live without it.
No.
And then, I don't know, make some phone calls, look at my computer. Email has changed my life considerably. I cannot remember what I did before there was email. I guess I would get on the phone and call people. I still do that, too.
Yeah.
And if I have, I usually don't pre-write most things. So, my deadlines are generally Monday morning, Tuesday morning.
Do you
Wednesday
wait till
morning.
The deadline's upon you to start, or do you
I do.
Plan?
I do. Well, not, 20 minutes before.
No, I understand that.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
So you're a little bit of a procrastinator.
Yeah, but it's just because that's the way I've lived my entire life. And
that's
the pace.
That's your style.
That's the pace that suits me. I mean, it's I don't want to sit and sort of make notes for a story I'm going to write in 5 days.
Right.
But then, I'm not like you. I don't go out I used to go out pretty considerably every night.
Yeah. Listen, from what I've heard, Rick, you did very well on your own. So
yes, there's some people who are now.
You had a nightlife column.
Yes, I did. That was one of the great job offers. Not a job offer. I was working for the Sun-Times, and someone, I guess Jim Hogue, someone said, "How old are you now, Rick?" I go, "Yeah, I think I'm 26, Mr. Hogue." Why? Well, how would you like to be the nightclub and bar tavern critic? I'm like, oh my God! Did I die and go to heaven? It was something. And eventually, a lot of those columns were collected in a book. I created this character called Dr. Nightlife, and it was fun. It was a great deal of fun when you have people like, Artie Morton the scene.
A lot of characters to write about.
Oh, God, yeah. A lot more characters. You still have people like Steve Lombardo, and there are a few others, or Billy Deck and all the others around, but it's not as frenetic as it once was. But
it's still fun.
It's still fun. As you well know, dear.
Listen, you've written 8 books. Is that correct?
No, I think it's more, but I...
More than 8.
I think.
You know, at one time I had read that you were writing a children's book.
I'm still writing a children's book. It's called Deadline the Dog Detective. Yes, that's been one going around for a long time.
That's cute. Why aren't you... How long is it going to take to write a children's book?
Not sure, I don't have an editor breathing down my neck. I don't have a deadline.
So you could do it at your leisure.
Yeah. I go back to it every once in a while and, fool around with it. And, there's a novel kicking around and...
What about?
Life in Chicago. It's a very Chicago-centric novel titled Riverview. For the famous old amusement park used to be at Belmont and Belmont and Western.
Sure, I've heard of it. Chuck talks about it all the time. Okay, now I'm going to ask you another...
Yes.
What were you going to say? I didn't mean
to... You can ask me anything.
Okay, what books are on your nightstand now?
Okay, because I'm sitting at home, I have a book I just wrote about called Country and Midwestern, Chicago in the History of Country Music and the Folk Revival by a local writer named Mark Guarino, and it's spectacular. It is, for me, it was like revisiting old gone friends like Steve Goodman and John Prine and Fred Holstein, and it's a remarkably evocative book about the music scene in Chicago, and it gives justice to why Chicago was such a vibrant center for those two movements. Then I have sitting here too is another book. I am not a big fan of what one calls graphic novels.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine, a man named Adrian Mateka, who is the editor of Poetry Magazine, has a book in collaboration with a guy named Youssef Daoudi called Last on Its Feet, Jack Johnson and the Battle of the Century. It is one of the most striking, artful, moving books about Jack Johnson, who most people remember as James Earl Jones from The Great White Hope.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It's very current to our times. He was the first black heavyweight boxing champion who was thrown in jail for the Mann Act. It's a remarkable book, and this artist, who I don't know, is tremendous, just tremendous. There's always something on my on my nightstand, as they say.
I love it. Well, obviously you read books and not Kindle, correct?
Correct. Okay. I've read a couple books on Kindle, I think, you know, when I was away somewhere or
travel. Yeah.
Well, and sadly too, you've been someplace where you can't find a bookstore.
Exactly,
you know,
right. Yes.
Yep.
If you weren't a writer, Rick, what other talent would you like to have?
I'd like to own Twitter, and so I could just so I could fold Twitter. I'd pay off all the people who work there. Say, here, here's $1 million, go away, and no more Twitter. That's a good question. I've been a writer for so long, Candace.
Right.
You know, what I like to have done, I'd like to have been Frank Sinatra. I mean, I think that's a pretty cool life. I'm pleased with my life. I don't think I would.
Oh, you should be. Absolutely should be.
I don't think I would do anything else. Perhaps being a big league pitcher for a year or so. Mm-hmm. But I've met so many interesting people, and so many good people, and a few bad people, and it's been a rich life.
Yep. All right. I have three more questions.
And I know you too.
Oh, I love you. You're so sweet.
And Chuck, yes.
Well, he
and John, well.
And John,
of course.
It's a love fest right here. Right here on the podcast, it's a love fest.
You don't hear that very often.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Right, questions. Three more questions. What is your idea of perfect happiness?
Perfect happiness?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know yet. And that's one of the things that keeps me alive and active, mm-hmm. and keeps me waking up every day, thank God,
mm-hmm.
And wonder that the idea of perfect happiness is the next day, because
I
do not know who I'm going to meet, what I'm going to read, what music I might hear, what play I might see, what thing I might learn.
Ooh,
that's my idea. My idea of perfect happiness is waking up in the morning.
Yeah,
because
and not
the day.
Knowing.
Well, because the day unfolds. That every mm-hmm. day is different. Day unless you're, you know,
in jail.
Jail can be interesting too. On the next podcast, I'll tell you about my jail experience in Florida. Yeah, that would be it.
That's good. That's a good answer. Okay, now what is your most treasured possession?
That is a good question too. It is certainly not this computer. that's a good. I suppose it would be whatever my soul is, because that's the engine, whatever the engine is that keeps me running, or the fuel that keeps me running, that is my most prized possession. I can't buy it, but I do cherish it. No question about it. Good answer.
And what advice would you give to young people who want to be writers?
Write, read, and write. Don't worry about where you're writing. Don't worry about for whom you're writing. But it is terribly important that you read. Find writers that you admire. Don't worry if they're unfashionable. Don't worry if your friends say, well, you know, you can only write 140 characters somewhere. Reading is the best teacher for writers. read. I'm not saying read everything. Read, follow your passion. I mean, follow mm-hmm. your passion. If you like to read about butterflies, read about butterflies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it's an overlooked kind of thing, because mm-hmm. people will tell you, well, you didn't spell this word right, or you shouldn't be writing about this nonsense. Mm-hmm. You can write about anything, especially now. There are a million outlets. Getting paid to write is a completely different matter.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that on the next podcast.
Anytime, Candace. This is so fun for me.
Well, I have one last question.
Yes, ma'am.
How would you like to be remembered?
Basically, just by this podcast. If that's all people, if it's all people remembered, I don't care. I do not care. I think that if I have, and I'm pretty sure I have, if I have touched people's lives, strangers, I have a considerable number of friends, I would like to be remembered as someone who gave a shit.
Oh, God, I love that. That's perfect. Oh, well, Rick, thank you a million times.
Oh, honey,
it's always
great. This is
Volume
1 of Rick Kogan on Candace's podcast.
You are a legend. You are an absolute legend. And I
so
can't
are you,
thank
honey.
You
enough. So are
I love
you.
You, honey. Thanks
love you,
for
too.
Being
I love you, too, John.
Uh-huh. Thanks, Rick. Too. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, kids.
All right.
Take care.
You, too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
He's gone.
Oh, God, is he
Listen,
good.
You know, I always tell people working on radio that, you know, like he said, I've had a long career, and you get to meet so many different people. But you're talking about a guy... in Chicago especially, that is literally the living embodiment of what this city's all about, or should
exactly.
be.
Exactly.
That's
yes.
how I've always seen him. And, you know, when I was on WGN for a couple of years in 2013 and 14, one day I had just finished doing, I don't know, it was probably on 9 to noon or noon to 3. I can't remember what. Mm-hmm. And I come walking out of the front of the Tribune Tower. It was still just the Tribune Tower. And WGN had that fishbowl radio
yeah,
station up
right,
front.
Right, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I walked out, and he's out front smoking a cigarette. Mm-hmm. And I walk by, and he grabs my arm, and he goes, I know who you are. I said, I know who you are, friggin' Rick Kogan. He goes, I've been watching you for a half hour through the window. God damn, you're good. And I said, because you could hear the radio outside on the street.
Yes, right.
And I'm like, and so ever since that time, I'm just a huge fan of this guy. And I just think he is like one of the, he's like one of the last real true conglomerate greats of writing, speaking. Everything he says is, I just keep thinking, they could name it Koganville and it'd be okay.
That is exactly the truth.
Right?
That is so well said, John. I love that. Absolutely love it. You're right. Koganville. We live in Koganville, and
Pretty
I'm
much.
Happy to be here.
Yep, yep.
Pretty much happy to be here. Well, bless his heart. Well, that was great to have him on, I'm telling you.
Were you nervous talking with him, even though you know him well? Is it hard? You turn the tables. He always interviews you. So how was this for you to do that?
Well, I just didn't. Here's the thing. This whole thing is, I didn't want him to be disappointed in me.
Ah.
That's the whole thing. I mean, I wasn't nervous, but I just didn't want me. I didn't want to ask any stupid questions. I didn't want to be redundant with questions he's heard 1,000 times before.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted him to, you know, not to be proud of me, quite frankly,
because
I really
is.
Admire him so much. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
and there are
real.
Not many left like that that can do everything he's done. Author, columns, the columns that he writes.
TV, radio,
TV,
everything.
All that stuff. And I loved what he said, that he never went looking for it. And what you said and what both of you said was so important. I think what you're looking for is looking for you somewhere. And mm-hmm. when you show up, amazing things come out of it. And, you know, the whole thing about not wanting to do TV or radio, these are all things that you attract when you're doing what you're supposed to do. And he's done that like very few people I know.
Exactly. I agree 100%. Oh, my God. Yeah, mm-hmm. that was really thrilling. Well, let's see. So what are we going to talk about now?
Well, I'm tired now.
See,
just
John,
listening.
Now we're exhausted. let me just start with a few things. Hold on. Let me look at my notes. God, I'm so caught up in him. I've lost.
You know
all
what
my
it is? I always try to, you know, I try to explain people. There's a couple guys in my life that have great voices. Kogan's one, and Bill Curtis is the other.
Yes, exactly. Well, John, you've got a great voice.
Well, but
voice
I can't
yourself.
Hear it. Well, I appreciate that, but I can't hear it. I hear them.
Well, I'm just telling you.
Well,
so
I'll take that.
Take it to the bank.
I will, and I think of Kogan's voice like if you went down North Avenue, and you took the gravel that's in the pothole they used to fill it, and you ran it through a strainer and then threw like a half a bottle of bourbon in there, shook it all up.
Yeah.
That's Rick Hogan's voice.
Yeah. It's unique. So distinctive. Oh, yeah. I mean, like none other. I mean, here, look, I told you, I told him, my 95-year-old aunt, never, and she thinks that about. So
well,
anyway,
that's good.
Well, you know, I told you over the weekend about my situation
and
with
go ahead.
Well, I wasn't going to talk about this because it's a little embarrassing, obviously, but you know, I so many people, women, I guess, especially have done this. So I'm just going to share. So
yeah.
I was going to an event at Maple and Ash, very fancy afternoon lunch with some beautiful women. I was really excited about it. It was an event for like maybe 60 girls, and it benefited Silver Circle, which is a nonprofit that provides services for women in need. So anyway, I got my best outfit, took 2 hours to get dressed, worked extra hard on my hair and makeup. I was so thrilled. Chuck drove me so my hair wouldn't get messed up in the wind. I arrived, I go in, and I said, yeah, I'm looking for Mary Lasky's party. And she looked at me with this quizzical look on her face, and she says, oh, you mean the one that's tomorrow? And I went, oh, well, you know, here's the thing. I'm here a day early, so when you see me come back tomorrow in the same exact outfit, act like you don't know me and have never seen me before. Now, you know, I know people have done this. I'm not the only one. But the problem with this is that I seem to do this a lot, and I'm starting to worry about myself. Have you ever done anything like that, Sean? Please say yes.
Yeah, many times.
Okay, good.
You feel better?
All right. Yeah, I feel much better. I know you're lying through your teeth.
Yeah.
But really, are you lying?
Well, no, I can't imagine. I've been early for things and really late for things, but I don't think I've ever showed up anywhere it was the wrong day that I can remember. Of course, I can't remember. It could have happened.
Okay, now I feel horrified. all right, let's talk about something else. Did you see where Illinois is going to have the largest movie screen?
I did
see
that. Yes.
That's exciting. 94 feet wide and 5 stories tall. Is that amazing?
I remember when what's the IMAX when that was like the biggest thing in the world. This is ginormous.
This is ginormous, and they're going to have a dozen auditoriums, reclining heated seats. I mean, come on. How far away is Batavia? That'll be the deciding
road trip.
Factor. Yeah, road trip. Well, maybe I'll have to pass on that super EMX. Okay, let's see. So here's another thing. I went to a Paws Chicago Animal Magnetism Party. Now, you know Paws is one of the they're also the largest no-kill shelter in the Midwest. And they hosted this Animal Magnetism Party at Morgan Manufacturing. And they had over 700 guests there. I mean, it was jam-packed. And one of the people that they honored, who's a big supporter of animal welfare, believe it or not, is CM Punk, the wrestler, also known as Phil Brooks. Do you know of him, CM Punk? He's
super popular wrestler. It's been a while since he's been active, I think, on the big screen, big stage, I should say. Yeah, I know who
but
he is.
So he was given an award for his outreach and his support of animals. And, you know, since the Paws was founded in 1998, they have saved over 76,000 pets.
Wow.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, that's there. I know that they are really close to your heart.
They are close to my heart. And, you know, I want to mention one thing. Three events.
Mm-hmm.
Flair is a benefit for the Chicago Lighthouse. It's called Eye on Fashion. It's going to be a luncheon, afternoon lunch and fashion show. It's going to be at the Ritz-Carlton on September 22nd. And we're going to honor Tracy Tarantino de Bono. She is a fabulous woman who produces fashion shows. She owns Zazz Productions. And it's going to be an exciting day to help those who are blind or disabled and the veteran communities, too. So that's a benefit for those things. Also, on October 13th, Eversight will have its 25th anniversary celebration at the Peninsula. And we are going to honor John Robeck, who was the former president, CEO of Greeley and Hansen, who we interviewed here on the show.
Yes.
So he's going to be the honoree then. So it's going to be really super exciting. I want to give a mention to Amdur Productions, who they do all of the art fairs and festivals in and around Chicago. They are absolutely spectacular. And on June 17th and 18th, they will have the Gold Coast Art Fair they will produce. So it'll be here. And I love the Gold Coast Art Fair. Do you like art, John?
Yeah, you know, we probably have different, you know, I think we talked about this. My paint-by-numbers stuff kind of is where it ends for me.
Oh, that's right. I forgot you like the paint-by-numbers
stuff. Paint-by-numbers. I'm good.
Well, bless your little heart. Finally, before I go, I would like to invite you all to join Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas and myself tomorrow when we will be doing our third Random Acts of Kindness. Now, this is an event where the whole public is invited to help us give out flowers and chocolates, anything that we can do to put a smile on people's faces. And we're going to be joined by Fresh Farms International, who's going to donate the flowers, along with Bloom and Toss, and also Black Men United, with Maria Pappas and I tomorrow, May 13th, northeast corner of Michigan and Pearson, from noon to 1:30. I hope you can join us. Well, I want to close with, you know, I always have something that's inspirational I try to close with. Unless you have anything you want to add before I get to the close?
No, ma'am. I mean, this is your show, and I just was so thrilled to be kind of just off camera here and off mic listening to Kogan. I've known the guy on and off for years. Huge fan, huge admirer. He rarely does this, I think, as open as he was and forthcoming as he was, and I just enjoyed the shit out of it.
Oh, good. Me too. I mean, I was so thrilled that he said yes. I mean, he's just one of a kind. That's all I can say. So this is something that happened. You know, I told you before that I'm from a small town in southern Illinois. It's DuPo, Illinois. And I grew up with this darling guy called Paul Weber. And he does woodworking in his spare time as a hobby. And so I had posted on Facebook this inspirational few words, sentences saying, and he saw that on my Facebook page. He made it into a wooden keepsake. And so now I have this from him, and I'm going to read you what I like the most, why I like this so much. So some of these are obvious, but others are something you have to think about. So number one, do the things you love more often, which is kind of a given, duh. Number two, let go of people or situations that drain you. Number three, sometimes you need to get uncomfortable to be comfortable. Number four, wherever your attention goes, your energy flows. And the last one, if you change your mindset, you will change your life. Now, wow. John, I know that you are a wonderful motivational speaker, and you share so many words of wisdom and have in all of your speeches. Give me something of yours to leave guests
with. Well, I sign a lot of my books with Go Within and You'll Never Go Without.
Oh, that is good. And you did that just at the spur of the moment off the top of your head.
I literally just signed 10 books today, so it's at the top of my head. But I didn't know you were going to ask me that, but I've always found that was, in addition to these great things the gentleman sent you, I found that that's like the thing, and it's the thing that people fear the most but need the most, which is to find out who you are. Rick said so much himself today.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
The same thing. I just condensed it down. But if you go within, you'll never go without, and it's always been true for me.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, I love it. That was wonderful. Well, one last thing I want to mention. I know that you have just finished a wonderful book that you've been working on about Randy Hundley. Tell us all about that. Tell us a little bit about it.
I got to tell you, this has been, this is probably my sixth or seventh book, as they call ghostwriting. Some of them for ground up, start to finish, and some are revisions and all different levels of things. But this one, and I've said this before in your show, it came to me in such an amazing way. I was a kid, like so many people who listen to this show, in the 60s and 70s, and I grew up on the street corners of Chicago waiting for Cubs autographs, and Randy Hundley was one of my guys, if not the guy. And I my first paid writing gig was for the now defunct Chicago Sports Profile magazine, 1993. I got paid $250 to go to the Randy Hundley Fantasy Baseball Camp and play baseball for 3 days. Write about it. Oh, well, that was difficult. And, you know, it's a lot what Rick said, you know, when you learn to write what you know and the things that are important to you, you'd be amazed. I don't even know how that happened, but it happened. And I remember vividly going to the camp. It was at UIC for a couple of days before we played at Wrigley Field, the holy grail of baseball stadiums, right?
Yes.
And I got to the camp at UIC, and I was so excited to meet him again. I had not started on radio yet. This was the first thing I ever did in print. So it was really long before a lot of what I'm known for now had even existed. It was the first thing I ever did. And I went in there, and there he was, Randy Hundley wearing number 9. I went up to him. I kind of stammered this and that. And I said, you know, Mr. Hundley, I said, I was one of those kids, you know, that on the corner, and then this thing happened here, and you pulled up to your Corvette. And he's looking at me. He's like, yeah, that's great. Start running. Start doing laps. So I was the rookie at camp. I did the laps. And we've stayed in touch ever since. When I was at Harpo, I had him on with Dr. Oz. When I was at WGN, of course, he was on with me. And we've just played golf together. And probably 8-9 years ago, before I even did a lot of this book stuff, I said, you know, your life should be between the covers of the book. And didn't know it'd be me that writing it.
Oh, my goodness.
And so last summer, just as he had turned 80, he called me, and I was in Michigan with my son spending some time. And he called and says, he's got this great Virginia drawl. You know, he's well known for that voice he has, another great voice. He says, well, John, what do you think about doing that book? And I said, what book? And he's my book. And so we met, and for the last year, I suppose, just about, we've been working on this together. His health's been a little up and down here and there, but he pushed through it. And it has been, you know, it took a while for me to kind of shake off the cobwebs that I get a chance to do this with this guy. And Rick talked about not being intimidated or you know, even infatuated. Yep. I'm past that on this one. I was a kid. And he stopped for me and autographed my book and my mitt. And to think that all these years later, the baseball gods saw fit for me to do this, I was over the moon. Still am.
Isn't that amazing it how is. Things come together like that?
Yeah, and it should be out this July. I would think we're pushing, you know, we're kind of in the final phases of it. The actual writing of the book is done. Now we're just cleaning up details and things like that. And I'm so excited to be there with him when this happens, and so excited for Cub fans and baseball fans. I've had people involved in the book that are Sox fans. Just goes to show you.
Oh, well, listen, he's a legend. I mean, that's exciting. So you're going to let me do your book launch, right?
Yes, and we'll set it up. Absolutely. You have to be there and cover this, and we can talk about it. And if I can figure out all the technical pieces to get Hundley on, we'll have him on the show.
Oh, you betcha. We sure will. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you again, John, for being with me on another fabulous edition. I'm excited about this show.
Good.
Thanks. And thanks to all who listened in, and I hope you tune in next time and follow me on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, you name it, I'm there at Candid Candace. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Candid Candace podcast. For more of what's going on in Chicago, go to CandidCandace.com.